Welcome to Exploration 1, Lecture 10. And yes, I know last week was Lecture 11. This one's Lecture 10 because I missed Lecture 10. So we're just going to do them out of order, just because that's the sort of person. Now, today we are talking about the content of Module 8, which is... let me look at my notes... The physical layer, and I think I've talked about a lot of this in the past as we've gone through the various modules, but we're going to whip through this and then I'm going to put it up on the server so that anybody who's missed the lecture today can pick it up and listen to it. Okay, the physical layer encodes... do you have any general questions on exploration stuff before we continue, Brian, by the way? I have somebody who's written a JAWS script that will get you into the list view of SM Sniff. So as soon as I have that, it will go up on the website and you don't have to worry about the inaccessibility of not being able to tab back into the list view. There is a hotkey that puts you back there.
Oh, good. I mean, it works, but you can do it, but it's nice. A hotkey would be nice.
Yeah, Chris N. from The Zone scripted it up, apparently. And he'll give me the scripts at some point to make that happen. I know Pranav was talking about it, but it looks like that Chris has done it, so it will go up on the website. Okie dokie. The physical layer encodes binary digits into signals that can travel over the media, copper, fiber, or wireless. So it is worth considering that wireless is a medium as much as copper and fibre is. For physical layer, you need the physical media and the associated connectors. Yeah, I know that sounds pretty obvious, but if ever you've tried to do a cabling project and you don't know what sort of connectors you need and how they hook onto the cable and stuff, it can be a bit of a challenge. And no, we do not crimp BNC connectors onto the end of coaxial cable with a pair of pliers. It doesn't work very well. A representation of bits on the media, so how the bits are actually going to be stuck on the media. We tend to use schemes that are a little more complicated than volts for one and no volts for zero. It's a little bit more complicated than that. We don't go into the mind-boggling complexities, luckily, in this course, but suffice it to say there are various ways of encoding the signal to maximise the number of bits transmitted at a particular baud rate. Now, baud rate refers to the number of line transitions per second as opposed to the bit rate, which is how many bits per second you actually get across the media. And often the bit rate is higher than the baud rate. As you would probably remember from modem days, you often have a baud rate of 2400. However, using things such as quadrature amplitude modulation or QAM, it is possible to get 9600 or 14400 bits per second over a 2400 baud link. So, please don't say baud unless you mean baud. I'd prefer you say bits per second. Because that's just one of those pedantic things. Obviously, the network devices have got to have transmitter and receive circuitry. That's pretty important. Now, it's also worth mentioning that the media does not carry the frame. The frame is a Layer 2 concept that is in the data link layer, which we've already spoken about. The frame, it actually carries bits on the media, not the actual frame itself. So the media doesn't really care about the frames. Now, the physical layer standards are set by engineers such as the ISO, Institute of Electronic and Electrical Engineers, or IE, ANSI, American National Standards Institute, and the International Telecommunications Union, ITUT, which is Swiss, which is why it doesn't stand for International Telecommunications Union. The Electronic Alliance Industry... or EIA, / TIA, because it's a telecommunications industry thingy as well. And there's the FCC and those sorts of people that are responsible for making sure all these standards interoperate. There are four types of things defined. The physical and electrical properties of the media. How many volts are you going to put over this stuff? What temperatures can it stand up to? What sort of insulation does it have to have? At what temperatures is it rated to run? How bendable is it? How thick is it? What is the gauge of the wire that's in it? Gauge measured in AUG, which is a standard gauge measure, and can't remember how it works, but it's the bigger the AUG, the smaller the gauge, or something. It's something to do with how they pour the material. It's really odd. We looked it up a number of years ago. Mechanical properties, in other words, the dimensions of the media, which I just spoke about, the pinouts, the connectors, that sort of thing. If any of you have ever seen the little retaining latch break off an RJ45, you will understand some of the shortcomings in some of the mechanical retention mechanisms that we have been using for quite some time. How the bits are encoded on the media. So are we using Manchester encoding? Are we using modified frequency modulation? Are we using run length limited? All those sorts of things. 4D, 5D, which we're not actually going to go into, but how are the actual signals getting across the media? And the definition of the different control signals. So how do we notate start bits, stop bits, framing, and those sorts of things. Now, the bits are actually encoded into the symbols that go onto the media. This allows for start and stop frame delimiters, and it also allows for synchronization and clock timing, which is important, otherwise things get out of sync. The receiver and transmitter must be synchronized by the clocks on either end, unless you're using, of course, asynchronous serial, which has a start bit, data bits, and some stop bits, and it doesn't actually need a synchronized clock. As far as Cisco is concerned, if we are using smart serial interfaces, which is what connects router 1 to router 2 and router 2 to router 3 in the bundle, router 2 has all of the DTEs on it. Data 2 has all the DCEs, I should say, which is data communications equipment. Router 2 is where you set the clock rate. So if you are connecting router 1 to router 2, you will need to set a clock rate on router 2 to tell it how fast to drive the serial interface, and then router 1 and router 3 will be able to figure out how fast the link goes, whether it's 64,000, 256,000, etc. There is also a show interface a sync or something that will actually tell you where the clock rates are actually set in case you forget that router 2 is where you set all the clock rates. And yes, I will be coming up with a ripper of a lab for you guys fairly soon that will have you connecting all the three routers together, so that will be fun for everybody. Now, amplitude and phase can be changed in the signal. That's one of the ways we can get information across the medium. Now, the transitions can actually be used, so you can actually watch for the voltage changes, and that can actually show you where the clock is. So, for example, when you're using Manchester encoding, it's actually the changes in the signal that are important to show you where the clock is, not what the actual voltage is at a particular time that actually denotes the data. It can also limit bit level error. Also, if you've got a good symbol encoding system, you can actually be somewhat resistant to electromagnetic interference and stuff like that. Ethernet has a preamble. It is actually 64 bits of preamble. The first 62 bits are an alternating pattern of 0 and 1, and the last two bits are 1-1. And that preamble is 64 bits long and is sent at the start of every frame. It allows the transmitter and receiver's clock to lock onto each other before the transmission of the Ethernet frame. It talks here a bit about code groups that can recode stuff for transmission on high-speed media. In very simple terms, when you are transmitting at gigabit, it uses all sorts of weird symbols and communications and coding stuff to pull off gigabit. And in fact, there are basically 6 signals transmitted in both directions at the same time, and the pairs are actually in a constant form of collision. It actually uses all 4 pairs, each pair being capable of 250 megahertz worth of transfer, so once you put the four pairs together with all of the tricks, you end up with gigabit transmission. Now, the other thing you've got is, for example, if you're working with optical fiber and stuff, you can actually use a symbol encoding called NRZ, which means non-return to zero, and that is so that you can change the phase and stuff of the light waves and stuff and not burn out your laser diodes. So they can reduce bit level error, limiting the effect of energy transmitted into the media, as I spoke about optical fiber. You can distinguish data bits from control bits with the symbols. Better media error detection. And you can also have data control and invalid data symbols so that you can actually warn somebody if the data that came across the media was actually invalid. Any questions on any of that so far?
I didn't think there was any correction mechanisms at layer one, like for, you know, invalid data. I didn't think it had any sort of retransmit mechanisms.
It doesn't have retransmit mechanisms, but it does have, there is actually some low-level error detection in at layer one that can at least tell you if stuff went bad. There's actually error detection and stuff on, it's a bit like the error detection on audio CDs at the C1 stuff that's done at the actual disc layer. It just tells you if something went wrong. There isn't obviously a huge amount of stuff you can do about it, but it will actually tell you if something actually went wrong. So it's sort of a, you know, look out, you may not be seeing what you expect to see.
Okay.
Now, the other thing they want us to cover is they want to cover bandwidth, throughput, and good put. Bandwidth, you've got two types of bandwidth. You have analog bandwidth and you have digital bandwidth. Analog bandwidth is measured in hertz, kilohertz, megahertz, gigahertz, and digital bandwidth is measured in bits per second, which is little b ps, as opposed to big B ps, which is bytes per second. The big B bytes you, okay? So if you've got big B ps, that is bytes per second, and if you've got little b, so the little b can sting you, that's bits per second. Very important when you are talking to your friends about how fast your internet connection goes and you've been on six different bandwidth testing sites and you're trying to see who's got the biggest number of BPS. Now, throughput is how much actual information you can get across the link in a given time. I've got some other things. It's analog and digital bandwidth, which I've spoken about. It depends on the limitations of the media and the laws of physics, as Scotty would say on Star Trek. Now, the throughput is the amount of data sent through in a given time, which depends on media usage. In other words, how many stations are accessing the station, etc., and number of network devices. Now, good put is what you actually get. So that's what the users actually see at their workstations, how fast their copy thinks it's going. And if you're on my network and you're copying things from my Linux file server, it's 5 megabytes a second, and it's dismally slow on a gigabit network. See previous link.
No, mine's the same, and I haven't figured out why. I still can't make it any better.
It's Windows 7. It really is, because if you put an XP machine on the other side of it, like if you actually go XP and Samba to and from the server, it cranks along at about 35 megs a second. But as soon as you plug a Windows 7 into the cable, the same cable, and the Linux machines can transfer stuff between each other at like 35 meg a second. It's phenomenal. Even with rsync, which is encrypted over SSH, if I do a raw FTP, I can clock 35, 36 megabytes a second. So maybe Samba 4 will fix it when it comes out. I hope so. various standards, maximum length. I'll cover a couple of these that are particularly important. The twisted pair, 10 base T, even 100 base T, 1000 base T, 100 meters, 328 feet. Technically, the standard actually says 90 meters from the vertical cabling to the switch panel and 10 meters for the drop leads to the workstation, but it is a maximum of 328 feet or 100 meters. Yes, you can get signals and retimers and repeaters and things that can make it go further, but they violate the standards, and if they work, good for you. If you put a switch in the middle of the link every 100 meters, that's another way to get around the timing limit, although you will increase, the distance limit, but you will increase your, you will increase your latency. It's a bit like wireless networks that claim you can go, 100 meters in open air, or 300 meters in open air, depending on which access point you're looking at. I know people who've got directional aerials and they have thrown wireless signals 20, 30 kilometers. However, there are parameters on those links that need to be changed to allow that to be reliable. Cables can be interfered with by noise. Yeah, really? Noise can come from electromagnetic interference, fluorescent lights, electric motors, all those sorts of things. Anybody who's used some of the Blazy/Freedom Scientific products will notice there is a certain amount of electromagnetic interference that gets into the headphone jack that you can actually hear when your little note taker is thinking. I'm not sure whether that's as true for the modern ones. But certainly the old ones you can hear when they're busy, which made a lot of blind people very happy. Twisting of pairs causes cancellation, so that it actually causes a magnetic field to be created around the cable, and that can help shield it from electromagnetic interference. There's category 3, 4, 5, and 6. 3, 4, and 5, you basically get more and more twists per meter. The twisting is tighter. And category 6 actually has a physical plastic separator that separates the pairs in the cable. And I will rely on your Google foo if you really want to know the specifics of the different categories. If you install cheap cable and you decide you're only putting in Cat 5 because you can't be bothered, and then your organisation decides to go gigabit and you really realise that you should have put in Cat 5e, this can be a very expensive mistake. Highly recommended that if you're going to do a new cable installation that you put in Cat 6 even. Just makes sense. There are three types of cables that the notes talk about here. They are in your test. Straight through cable. That is your standard patch lead. 1 and 2 are a twisted pair, 3 and 6 are a twisted pair, 4 and 5 are a twisted pair, and 7 and 8 are a twisted pair. And if you listen to the 2007 cable making recording, you will hear Geraldine sing the cable making song, which is the green, white, green, blue, white, orange song that she sings that tells you how all the pairs go. Warning, we do disclaim any discomfort that may result in listening to the cable singing song. The crossover cable has pairs 1 and 2 run to pairs 3 and 6, and they have pairs 3 and 6 run to pairs 1 and 2. These are generally used in cases where the devices do not perform auto MDIX or auto crossover logic. They allow you to connect a switch to a switch, a hub to a hub, a router to a switch, or a PC to a PC. Many people would have two computers and a crossover cable, and whilst it was a bit ghetto, it worked just fine, and you could actually get data to and from computers very quickly. What a lot of people didn't realize, and this was probably fairly cool back in 1999 if you'd actually known about it back then, was that it was actually quicker to get a FireWire cable and run a FireWire cable between the two FireWire ports on your computer, because you would actually get 400 megabits per second as opposed to the 100 megabits per second from your network card.
I never tried. I mean, I used to do it all the time, like for moving data, when people would get a new PC and they'd want to go from 98 to XP, and they had all kinds of email and things, and I'd set up, you know, static IPs on them both and run a crossover between them and share the drives, and I had data moving. And many, many, many times, but I never even thought to use a FireWire. Now, most of the machines probably didn't have FireWire, but it's a good idea.
Yeah, and in fact, the FireWire network interface comes up by default. Well, it especially comes up by default in Linux, and most of the UDEV scripts shut it down because it confuses the trop out of people, Ethernet over FireWire. But it certainly does. If you actually have FireWire connected, you do get a network interface that comes up over FireWire, and yes, it works just dandy. So, certainly worth knowing about. I mean, let's face it, who else uses FireWire for anything else unless you can avoid it? Even if it is faster, it just isn't as ubiquitous as USB. Although I remember back in 1999 when we decided that USB stood for useless serial bus, and we were still waiting for it to replace all of the serial and parallel ports. And I wonder if I'm the only one that sees a little bit of irony in the fact that you have all these amazing USB ports on the back of your computer, which are incredible and good and nice, and then you run out and pay $50 to $60 for a USB to Centronics device so that you can connect it to your parallel printer. I suppose that's how the world goes.
I still use one for my Juliet because I don't have one of the nice new ones that has an Ethernet port, and I can't afford one, so we will still convert my nice high-speed USB to good old parallel.
And I'm sure it works just fine. I mean, it's not as if Braille embossers are a high bandwidth device, because they've got to rattle all that stuff out anyway, so, you know, go figure. Rollover cable is where you've got pin 1 wired to pin 8, pin 2 to 7, 3 to 6, and so on. So 1 is to 8 and 8 is to 1. They are used for console cables. And on one end of the console cable, on both ends of the console cable, they are usually flat because they're not twisted pairs, so that's an easy way to tell them apart. And then you have the one end plugs into the console port of your Cisco router, and the other end usually has a little converter to convert it into a 9-pin serial or a 25-pin serial, which then plugs into your PC with a copy of TerraTerm, and off you go. Coaxial cable, very quickly, you have an inner conductor, you have an insulator, you have an outer braid, and you have an outer shell. The braid acts as shielding between the inner conductor, and it also acts as a return for the signal. You can read up the gory specifics in your notes. It's used for radio, cable TV, Ethernet, and stuff like that. Shielded twisted pairs like regular twisted pair, except the four pairs are wrapped in a foil jacket, which I believe is grounded at one end. Don't run twisted pair coax outside unless it's the really good stuff, because you have a danger to people, danger to building, and danger to equipment. There are plenty of people I have spoken to that have had their various antenna rigs hit by lightning, and in lucky stage that's all that's happened, and in unlucky cases their antenna rig has then gone and sent the lightning down into their very expensive gear connected to the other end of it, which doesn't go anywhere near as well after that happens to it. Insulation can cause problems if burnt or heated. Yes, PVC insulation emits toxic gas fumes that will kill you when it burns. So that's why you need to look at things like plenum cabling and stuff if you're adhering to the fire codes, or make sure that you are nowhere near this stuff when it is melting. Anybody who has melted anything electrical, me being one of them, will know exactly what it smells like when the special plastic smoke has been let out.
And good luck getting rid of that odor. Because I've
done a couple. It smells very bad. Fiber uses light and does not conduct electricity, which is kind of nifty because you don't get lightning traveling through fiber. Well, not in its electrical form, anyway. The fiber can have very high bandwidth over quite long distances. We are talking various numbers of kilometers, depending on whether it is single or multi-mode fiber. Single-mode fiber using a coherent laser, infrared laser, usually between 750 and 1350 nanometers in wavelength. And multi-mode fiber just using a light that you shine down. And that's got nothing to do with any popular rock song that has been recently released. We are talking about optical fiber. Different skills required for handling fiber. Don't get bits of glass stuck in your fingers. Know how to polish the ends of the fiber flat so that they don't refract the light when you try and shine it in the ends. And make sure you know how to actually crimp and stuff it together properly. Not an easy thing to do. Do not look into the end of an application. Oh, okay.
Like a fiber cable. And what are the connectors on the end? Just a morbid
curiosity. They are a thing called an SC. They're called a subscriber connector. And they're sort of this thin, sort of oval-shaped connector that... No, it's a thin, round connector that pushes into a little hole. It's actually...
Maybe I have seen them. I have them on my DVD player. It's a pocket cable, which in theory is fiber. But is network cable the same stuff?
Yeah, it's similar. I think the actual Toslink stuff isn't as high a grade because it doesn't have to go anywhere near as long a distances. But yeah, they are actually a subscriber connector that are on the Toslink cable. So yeah, you have seen them. Fiber needs two fibers to do full duplex. This is why Toslink is one fiber and you have a Toslink in and a Toslink out. In the network cables, you generally have the two fibers wrapped together in a sheath, and the little subscriber connectors are right next to each other, and the little full duplex thing plugs in and it's all good. Don't look into an active fiber because the light is infrared. That is to say that it will burn little holes in your eyeballs and you will not be able to see it, although it will be highly painful. So don't do it. Single mode fiber can go longer distance because the laser can be sent longer distances and you don't have as much dispersion in the fiber as you would with multi-mode stuff, so longer distances, better bandwidth. More expensive. Wireless media can travel through air but can be interfered with. Absolutely. Lots of people have trouble with their wireless, especially if they've got 2.4 GHz wireless and 2.4 GHz cordless phones. There was somebody else who had a treadmill that used to disrupt the wireless, apparently. I have no idea why, but whenever they got on the treadmill, it generated enough EMF to knock the wireless out, so no Facebooking while you're on the treadmill. Security is important on wireless networks. You need to look at things like WEP, wide equivalent privacy, which is pretty crummy and is crackable in about 60 seconds, if that, and some old note takers that aren't very modern can only do WEP, so that's what you're stuck with. It's also worth noting with WEP that there are actually at least two different hashing mechanisms to turn a passphrase into the four hex keys. It is worth noting that the only portable way to put keys in WEP in all situations is to put the hex keys in. Alright, so your 5-letter or your 10-letter password is not guaranteed to be portable. And whilst it might be correct in one device, I actually had two different routers that would hash the keys differently from the passphrase. So watch out with that one. WPA and WPA2 standardized the hashing mechanism for getting passwords into keys. Well done with that, guys. At last, we can actually put the passwords into things rather than those hex keys that are not much fun to get in. WPA2, much stronger than WPA, to be used wherever possible. Many routers allow you to have WPA auto, which allows you to use all the different sorts of WPA, and the router will automatically figure it out, except for when it doesn't. So watch out for that too. A wireless LAN has stations and access points. The access points mediate the communication between the wireless stations, and they take care of the funky bits of the CSMA/CA protocol, which is the carrier sense multiple access with collision avoidance. Mobility is really cool. The lack of cables is really cool. The security, not so cool. And that's the end.
Except I have a question, because it's always sort of intrigued me about these things. I've never done it at home, but I'm thinking of doing it, which is what got me thinking about it. What if I want multiple access points? There must be some protocol that they've implemented to hand off a signal. Like, okay, you're closer to this one, let's drop your signal from access point A and switch you to B. And I wonder how all that sort of funky stuff works, and I suspect there's some protocol for it.
I'm not actually sure. I think it's actually built into the... Okay, because what you've got to realize, and there's actually an entire wireless course, although I don't know whether Cisco's canned it or not, but basically an ESS ID, which is the one you're familiar with, is the one that names your network. So, for example, we've got a network here called CAVI, and that's the ESS ID. The BSS ID, which is the base service set ID, is actually the identifier that identifies the access point, and that is often a MAC address, or it can be something else. And if you connect lots of BSSs together, you can hook them all together into one ESS. In other words, you put all of the access points on the same ESS ID and connect them together with cables, so that you can communicate with whatever access point you happen to be closer to. So then what the software does is it looks at the RSSI, Receive Signal Strength Indicator, and it figures out which access point is stronger or weaker, and then associates to the access point based on the strength of the signal. And then various stacks and drivers have limits and stuff that you can set. The Ethero stuff, you can actually tune the roaming, but generally you overlap the cells so that it will wander seamlessly from one basic service set to the other. So for example, in our house there are three wireless access points called Shonky, and depending on where you are, if you are in the bedroom, you're likely to associate with the one in the computer room. If you are in the dining room, you're likely to associate with the one sitting on the dining room table. And if you're on the back patio, you are likely to associate with the one that's sitting across on the shelving. And that actually happens transparently and, for the most part, automatically. I still haven't had a definitive answer as to whether you put all of them on the same channel or whether you scatter them across different channels. At the moment, I think all of mine are on the same channel. So I've got to do some Googling and find out which way you're supposed to do that.
Yeah, and I'll experiment some, because what I want is at the front. I mean, I'm fine in the back, but if I go sort of outside in the front yard, I get dropout. And I like going out there because it's going to be summer, and I want to sit outside with my toys. So we have to fix that.
Yeah, there's a number of ways of doing it. The easiest way to do it, and the most sensible way to do it, is to actually put all of the access points onto the same internal cabled media, whether that be Ethernet, whether that be Ethernet over power lines, whether that be whatever else. It is possible to use WDS, which is Wireless Distribution System, and actually set up repeaters and stuff, but you will find that the latency will suffer quite badly if you actually do it all by wireless. So I would avoid WDS or repeater modes in access points unless there is no way to get the internal cabled infrastructure within range of your access point.
Oh no, I can. I mean, to get to the front of the house, I can just go through one wall, and I actually think there's a phone cable going there anyway, so I might not even have to drill. So we're going to run a cable.
Ah, that'll make life a lot easier. So yeah, that's how we do it. We've got all our access points sitting on the same cabled infrastructure. And then you generally set the same authentication keys on all of the access points. And in theory, when you wander from room to room and stuff, your iPhone / note taker / computer should roam pretty much seamlessly.
Well, in a couple of next week, we'll figure out what access point to buy. I have an actual Cisco branded, not Linksys one. And it's all right, but its range isn't that great. So I'm going to poke around and see what people like and things and figure out what to buy.
That door for you, don't I? All right. The ones we've found, and I don't know whether you guys can get them over there, but they're a thing called an UltraWAP, UltraWAP, and they are mind-bogglingly excellent. And they are an access point. That's all they are. They've got one Ethernet port on them, and they're an access point. They're not a router. They're not anything else. And they are absolutely amazing. But if you can't find those, good luck finding something else that works really well.
I'll look for them. I bet I can find them. If nothing else, I can find them on eBay, probably.
Yeah, they're really good, because they actually run in five modes. They can actually run in station mode, infrastructure mode, repeater mode, WDS mode, or bridge mode. And you just set it up to whichever one you want, and they're very cool.